the term jihad of the womb. It expresses this desire to wipe out Christians, jihad, right? And of the womb, because when you forcibly convert the woman, you're not only converting her, making less Christians, but all of her children will automatically be registered as Muslims. So, you know, why would these countries be interested in funding these networks? Well, it goes to that idea of Islamic supremacism, right? So all throughout the region, that's why it's not just happening in Egypt, but it's happening in Nigeria and Pakistan and other countries.
Welcome to the Christian Emergency Podcast, a podcast for Christians spooked by the growing hostility in the culture today. We will tackle a range of topics from current events, persecution, missions, and what it means to be the church. You will gain valuable insights from those experienced working with persecuted Christians around the world, insights we all need to chew on in these strange days. Together, may we help the church stand. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Christian Emergency Podcast. I'm Andy, your host. And one of the ways we here at the Christian Emergency Alliance are trying to strengthen the global church is by shedding light on issues and topics that don't get a lot of coverage, especially issues where Christians in certain parts of the world are being harmed or mistreated. And there's an active move to conceal that, to hide that fact. Those issues need to be known by us. We need to, as the global church, be praying over those topics, praying over those situations and the people involved. And one of those issues that I'm guessing, if you're listening to this, you probably haven't heard about is a pattern of activity going on in Egypt, specifically the kidnapping of Coptic Christian women and girls and the trafficking of them in Egypt. This is something that's been going on for a while, and there was recently a case, and we're going to look into that case, but we're very grateful that we're joined by somebody who's been looking at this for a while and who has a perspective that we can all learn from. We're joined by Lindsay Rodriguez of Coptic Solidarity. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to speaking with your listeners today.
Would you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and the ministry you're a part of?
Sure. I'm a missionary kid. I grew up overseas, came back to the U.S. and studied at Biola University. And from there, just had a heart for different human rights issues and quickly started working for an international persecution ministry called Open Doors. And there I was able to start their advocacy program and eventually transition to where I'm at now with Coptic Solidarity. So in all, it's been about 20 years of doing policy work, awareness, work with the U.S. government, as well as with the United Nations and foreign governments. So that's a little bit of my background. And Coptic Solidarity is an organization that works towards equal citizenship rights for the indigenous Coptic Christians of Egypt.
Okay. With that intro, would you tell us who are the Coptic Christians?
Yeah, the Coptic Christians actually trace their roots to the disciple Mark the Evangelist. And he's the one who brought the gospel to Egypt. So he's considered the founder of the Coptic Orthodox Church. That church has been there, obviously, for the last many years, but not as well known because Orthodox Christianity, Catholicism, there was four main bishops in the Orthodox Church, and the one in Rome wanted predominance. And so that's how the Catholic Church separated from the Orthodox Church. So these days, the Orthodox Church is primarily known by ethnicity, such as the Coptic one in Egypt or the Ethiopian, Russian, Serbian, etc.
So this is an ancient line of Christianity. They date back to the founding of the church, essentially 2,000 years. So at one point, all of what we now know as Egypt was Christian, and it obviously isn't now. How many of the Coptic Christians, how many Coptic Christians as a percentage are there in Egypt today?
That's a really good question because it's actually highly disputed in Egypt. the Egyptian government for years has tried to say that they don't know how many there are and to use estimates that are low. So previously it's been said that they are 10% of the population. But actually just last year, Pope Tadros, who is the Pope of the Coptic Orthodox Church, released new information showing that they're closer to 14% of the population. And in a country the size of Egypt, that's a significant number of people. But going back to your remark about at one point they were the majority of people in Egypt, that's a really important thing to discuss because a lot of people imagine that Egypt has been Muslim for a long time. But Copts are actually the indigenous people. So they're the people who trace their line back to the pharaohs, right, who the majority converted at the time when Mark brought the gospel to Egypt. So you have this majority Christian country, but through the decades of Muslim invasions all the way up through the, you know, the Ottoman Empire going forward, they were over the years forced to either convert to Islam to be killed or to pay the jizya. It's a tax, that's what we call it, but essentially it's to live as a second class citizen and to accept a whole list of regulations that make sure that you know that you do not have equal status with the Muslim population. So that is what's been happening since the time of the Muslim invasions. So there's never been a golden era where Copts actually had equal status since the Muslim invasions. And that's a really common misconception.
Yeah, and the numbers that you're citing, if those are closer to accurate, the 13-14% of the population, even if it is 10%, that's still a pretty astounding figure given the pressures that they have lived under for so many centuries as compared to other parts of North Africa, which were similarly suited, which were majority, if not entirely, Christian societies that were overwhelmed. And now you really can't find traces of Christianity in some of those locales. But in Egypt, it's still there. And it's still, that's a significant part of the population, a significant number of Christians. So what has their experience been like? And we'll turn in just a moment to this particular case and what's going on. But I do think that there's value in learning about these cultural dynamics at play for the church in these different countries for our audience. What has the last 10, 15 years been like for Coptic Christians in Egypt?
Yeah, I think we need to go back to the time of Mubarak, who was the leader of Egypt for over 30 years. He was a military dictator. During his time, he actually imprisoned the Coptic Pope for a few years, and he was stuck out in a monastery, but eventually was allowed to return back to the church. That was actually a very common practice all through the Muslim invasions to kidnap the Coptic Pope and force the church to pay a ransom to get him back. So we see the continuity of these actions. During that time, of course, Copts had a second-class citizenship, but there was a little bit more of a kind of an acceptance of their situation as second-class citizens. And there were fewer direct attacks on Coptic churches, fewer burnings of churches, but it was still, you know, it was not a great situation. There has continued to be, so transitioning into, there was the 1 year after the Arab Spring that the Muslim Brotherhood came to power. And that was a terrible year for Copts, right? That's when we refer to the Egypt Kristallnacht, when about 150 churches were burned right after the Muslim Brotherhood. Mohamed Morsi leader was taken out by the current leader who was President El-Sisi. So when he first was elected, Copts tended to be really, really supportive. We saw a lot of support from the U.S. government in terms of he'll make the situation better for Christians. And that was his promise. And, you know, I think a lot of Americans are still in this mindset, and sadly, a lot of our U.S. legislators, where they still think of Sisi as like the savior of the Copts. But if we look statistically, you know, how have Copts fared under his leadership as opposed to Mubarak, who was a dictator for 30 years? Well, we see more church closures, far more church attacks and burnings. We see far more just open attacks on Copts in the streets, countless of people just being shot, women being attacked, had their hair cut off. One was grabbed from behind by a man who tried to slice her throat. That's happened several times. the abduction of Coptic women and girls and forcing them to convert to Islam and marry Muslim men. All of these things we see a continuance and even worse. So I would say the situation for Copts at this point is, I often compare it to like pre-civil rights era in the United States, where there was a very, very clear distinction and Black people did not have the same rights as whites. That is very much the case, except that it often turns deadlier in Egypt. And so our organization very much is working towards overturning those systematic forms of discrimination.
We will return to the podcast momentarily, but first, a word from our sponsor. Being a Christian today can be hard. This is true if you live in a heavily persecuted country like Iran or areas where cultural pressures against Christians are growing fast like America and Europe. Fortunately, none of us have to stand alone. We are part of a giant body, one huge spiritual family that spans the globe. That is the church. The Christian Emergency Alliance is committed to helping the church stand, regardless of the pressures to come. As a 501c3 nonprofit, the Christian Emergency Alliance strives to help our spiritual family when persecution hits. We also strengthen the church by supporting ministry that makes Christ famous, defends biblical truth, and prepares fellow believers for challenges ahead. You have the opportunity to make a huge impact in this work today. Become a monthly financial ally of the Christian Emergency Alliance by signing up at christianemergency.com. Your support of $25 a month or a gift in any amount will bless those who need help in these darkening days. Help the church stand today, tomorrow, and in the days to come. Register today at www.christianemergency.com. And now, back to the show. Well, against that backdrop of the last several years and the pressures that this part of Christianity is living under, we have this case that came up in January of 2024, and it involved a young woman, a 22-year-old medical student named Irene Ibrahim Shahada. Can you tell us about Irene?
Yes, Irene's case is emblematic of a situation that had started under Mubarak, but has escalated in the last years. And that is a systematic targeting, abduction, and then hiding these women, forcibly converting them to Islam and forcibly marrying them off, which is essentially trafficking. So what happened to Irene, she was a medical student. She was taking her midterm exams, and in between exams, she disappeared. And this is a term that's often used in Egypt. They just say the girls disappear. Eventually, you know, the family went right away to the police station. They're well aware that these incidents happen. The police set the father on a wild goose chase to multiple places with, you know, leads that he could follow up on. Of course, none of them panned out. We know that she had one short phone call with her brother, and she was crying and, you know, distressed. But now the Egyptian police and government officials are saying that she voluntarily ran away with a Muslim man. So this is the narrative that is used, that these women fall in love and then they secretly run away and they don't want to tell their families that they want to convert. So they do it secretly. But what really happens, and this is very well documented, there's videos, there's also an excellent report, Jihad of the Womb, that we released in 2020 with a lot of specific cases explaining how the system works. But essentially local imams, so Muslim clerics, as well as government officials, as well as local police, all collude in the trafficking rings. So they select their targets. Often they plant people to get to know the woman or to, you know, join her at work, get to know her at school, so that there's an opportunity to maybe be in a taxi cab with her, to be walking with her, you know, in between classes, like with Irene. Often there's a planted person, and then the girl is abducted. And so this is everything from girls who are minors up to young women to married women with children who have disappeared. In nearly all of the cases, the police refuse to file the report right away. Some cases, they have threatened the family. A couple years ago, family went to protest outside the police station, and they actually beat up family members, breaking bones and imprisoning them for a couple nights. So what we're trying to express is that this isn't, you know, just a here and there kind of thing. These are hundreds and hundreds of cases of Coptic women who are being trafficked. And if they're released, if they're found, which is not very common, and it only happens if there's a lot of international pressure and a lot of awareness created about their abduction, there are no services provided to these women. There's no social system set up for them. In fact, they come back. They most likely, almost all of them have been assaulted. They've been oftentimes videoed and photos taken, and then they use that to shame them so that they will not come forward and share the details. And they also threaten the family members not to share. So it's a really sad situation, and we need to continue creating awareness and hopefully bringing back girls like Irene.
How many of you knew about this? It's not widely distributed. This is all being done quietly in the dark. Most of the global church is totally unaware of this practice unfolding. And I'm confident that this is happening in other places besides Egypt as well. But this is something that we need to be aware of. And I'll be honest, I was in Egypt in, I think, 2011. The revolution was underway or right following that. And it was the first time that I was talking with a local Christian, and almost like a whisper, he just kind of whispered about this thing that was going on with these girls being kidnapped. And at first I didn't know what to make of it. And I almost chalked it up to like a conspiracy, like, okay, a conspiracy theory. Sure. Yeah. These girls are just disappearing. And then I heard it from somebody else. And then I heard about it from somebody else. And again, they were speaking quietly about it. It was almost this thing that they were nervous about. They recognized it. And it was something that was serious that was going on. And finally I realized, no, this is a pattern. This is actually happening. And boy, I wish that the church was better equipped to come alongside these families, to come alongside them and to help them and to encourage them and to do anything we can for these young women. You mentioned the phone call that Irene was able to make to her brother, and she was reportedly distressed during that call. There was one other detail about that call that stood out to me, and that is that the phone was snatched from her, that she cried out, and the phone was actually snatched away from her. How did that call end?
That call ended with the Muslim captor yelling at the brother, see, you can tell that she's alive and go to hell. That was the end of it. And these calls like that are very common, that the family gets to talk to the girl or somehow they connect. And it really undermines this narrative that the girl ran away of her own free choice, because they've done these like forced conversion videos a few times where the woman has to wear a hijab. And she talks about how she, wanted to convert to Islam and marry this Muslim man. And in some of the videos, you can see their faces. They're like, trying not to cry. They're being directed from off screen. And I think one thing with some of the public conversion videos, those women, a couple of them have been returned because it was so obviously fake. But one thing that is so critical to the entire situation is that this is done with complete impunity. In all the years that we have tracked this, I do not know of a single person, a single government official, single police officer, anyone who has actually been held accountable in the Egyptian justice system for these abductions. So as you can see, it's like not only are they happening, but they're basically incentivized to continue the abductions because the Egyptian justice system is a complete fraud for anyone who is not Muslim. And there's also people who've been involved with the networks who talk about being paid for every girl that they successfully kidnap. So there's the monetary incentive as well.
Yeah, this is a disgusting, vile practice that's playing out. It's benefiting from the clandestine nature in which it's treated when it's well known in the country and in the communities where this is happening, but we have been largely ignorant of it. It is disgusting. If this happened to my daughter, if this happened to my wife, this is the nightmare that these people are living through. It is repulsive. The fact that on that phone call, the phone snatched out of her hands, obviously she's traumatized and crying. And yet the state security still drags their feet. It seems like that they probably know exactly where this woman is.
Yes.
And yet they're still, mum is the word. That's pretty hard for me to swallow.
And that's actually a really good point that they know exactly where the girls are. That's one of the points I forgot to mention is that they have safe houses set up. So when the minor girls are kidnapped, they hold them there until they're of a legal age to issue a new ID with Muslim on their ID card. So they know exactly where they are, and they can bring them back whenever there's enough international pressure. Again, with the case of Irene, I haven't fully vetted this, but we have heard reports that her male family members were called in by the police and national security and threatened to stop talking about her case publicly. And also the Facebook page that was organized to help bring her back was shut down by the government.
Wow. Well, I'll just say this. We need to be praying for this family. My heart goes out to those male relatives who have canvassed the country looking for their daughter, for their sister. I can't imagine being in those shoes. And honestly, as Christians, that's our spiritual niece who's in trouble. And those are our spiritual relatives, our brothers and sisters in Christ. And my goodness, we need to be lifting them up and praying for a return of Irene back to her family. We do need to pray for justice and that evil would fall in and on itself, that those who are laying these traps would be frustrated. Those plans would be frustrated. And I just pray that more daylight would be shed on all of this so that it could get the transparency and the coverage that it warrants and deserves. I do believe that in this case, there was a man arrested. I don't know any details of that, if that was just the usual suspects that were brought in or if this was somebody that was actually involved. But it did stand out to me that his identity was concealed. Why was that?
Well, I don't know the specifics of this particular arrest, so I can't say positively, but I would say that my best guess is it would be concealed because he's going to continue to be involved with the networks of trafficking, and because the police and the government officials are involved, they want him to continue without any repercussions. As you can see, the deck is stacked completely against cops, all the local government officials, the police, the justice system. There really is no way of getting help. And I think that's why it's really important for listeners, if you know you want to do something concrete about this, you can write to your members of Congress and your senators and raise the issue of the abduction of Coptic women and girls in Egypt. We have run some campaigns in the past, like petitions that people can sign. But, you know, often members will take action when they hear about it from their constituents. So that's something, and, you know, it's not just in Egypt, but this is happening the same pattern to Hindu Christian girls in Pakistan, as well to Yazidi women and Christian women in Iraq. As well as Christian women in Nigeria, which I'm sure you all are very familiar with.
Yeah, this is really mind-blowing. It's hard to talk about. It's not something that I enjoy talking about, but it's so critical for these families. And let's just call a spade a spade. These are trafficking rings.
Yep.
These are trafficking rings that are set up and run. There's religious motives involved. All kinds of nefarious motives are involved in this, but they're preying upon the vulnerable. And in Egypt, that's these Coptic Christian women, these Christian communities, and they're preying on them. They know that they can get away with these crimes, and they just continue to do it. And it's not crimes of opportunity. These are orchestrated. They're set up. They're done on purpose, and they're done at scale, and they're done consistently. And there have been reports that several girls are treated to this every year. And in some cases, multiple women from different districts are kidnapped each month. So this is very serious. One of the things that you mentioned is the word networks. Who is running those networks?
Yeah, I mean, we believe that there are, Muslim terrorist groups who are part of the funding Muslim Brotherhood. But I believe with the network that it's not just the the terrorist groups behind it, but a lot of funding for these activities we know comes from the Gulf, comes from Saudi Arabia, comes from a variety of different countries. And I think the overarching purpose, why are they funding this? Why are they trafficking? one of our colleagues, Raymond Ibrahim, is actually the one who gave us this idea of the use of the word, the term jihad of the womb. Why did we name our report that? We did because it expresses this desire to wipe out Christians, jihad, right? And of the womb, because when you forcibly convert the woman, you're not only converting her, making less Christians, but all of her children will automatically be registered as Muslims. So, you know, why would these countries be interested in funding these networks? Well, it goes to that idea of Islamic supremacism, right? So all throughout the region, that's why it's not just happening in Egypt, but it's happening in Nigeria and Pakistan and other countries. So, yeah, I think it's really important to kind of understand that broader context of why this is being done. And of course, there's also, you know, the ability to have one of these women who now becomes, you know, your sex slave, who becomes the person who, you know, has to clean your house and cook and do whatever you want, basically. So then you have slave labor. So there's a lot of incentives for these people who don't believe that women have value, you know, in the first place, and much less a Christian woman. So, yeah, that's the situation.
Yeah, the best word that comes to mind to describe all this is evil. This is just evil. We want to expose that, and we want to do everything we can to combat it. Once upon a time in Egypt, not that long ago, there was an advice and guidance practice in Egypt that involved conversions. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And is that still in place?
Yeah. So under Mubarak, that law was still in place. And basically it said that if you wanted to convert, then the person had to be with a member of their clergy, right, from the religion that they currently were, and a member of the family to be there to discuss with them in private whether or not this is what they really wanted. So, you know, example would be if Irene really did want to convert to Islam and marry a Muslim, then she could have gone and met with her priest and met with, you know, maybe taken her father with her and had this discussion to see if it was of her own free will. Under El-Sisi, those sessions have been done away with. So when these girls, you know, show up in these videos, you know, saying that they willingly converted, or, you know, when the police say, oh, you know, they wanted to change their religion and they don't give it back to the family. Now there's no like a fallback where they can go and yeah. They can talk in private without their captor there in front of them or the, you know, the person who's been abusing them. And so that's one of the, you know, a very common sense thing for justice is that the person needs to be able to speak freely without duress. And that's not possible anymore. So people who say that El-Sisi is improving the situation for cops definitely are wrong. And they need to look into the details of what he's done for cops. Building, you know, the largest cathedral in the Middle East doesn't equate to religious freedom. It means it's probably the largest show church in the Middle East.
We appreciate the work that you all are doing, championing these people who need more champions. As we wrap up, is there any other parting comments or things that you would like us to consider or know?
Sure. Well, firstly, I just like to say thank you so much for highlighting this specific issue, because as you said in the intro, it is not very well known in the U.S. and it's usually talked about in whispers because, you know, repercussions for those people. So thank you for creating awareness. I would just emphasize again that it really does make a difference when you write your members of Congress and senators. I spend a lot of time on Capitol Hill talking to legislators and to their staff. And that's often they say, well, I haven't heard from anybody about this topic yet. So, you know, definitely please do that. And then I would also just flag that we are working with other organizations. We're hosting a side event next week on the sides of the Commission on the Status of Women at the UN. And that event will be focusing specifically on what's happening to these women who are trafficked and kind of what are the areas where they are falling through the social network that should be catching them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Lindsay, for sharing some of your time. I hope that if you're in touch with anybody involved in this case or other related cases, that you would express to them how there are Christians around the world that are learning about this and that we will be praying for them and that we're going to do everything we can to look for ways that help can be delivered and just that they're not forgotten or alone. Thank you very much again, Lindsay.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us today for the Christian Emergency Podcast. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. Also, tell your friends about us and ask them to subscribe as well. To learn more about the Christian Emergency Alliance or financially invest in our ministry, visit us at www.christianemergency.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you again for listening and stand strong out there.